Okay, so today we are going to lump in a few different types of subdisciplines of genetics. Each one of these you can, in fact, take a class in these areas if you get to grad programs. As I mentioned earlier in the semester, my PhD is actually in genetics, even though I'm a professor of microbiology. And the first thing that we're going to talk about this morning was one of those things that when I was an undergrad, I would take genetics classes, and they would say, and if we have time at the end of the semester, we'll talk about organelle genetics. And we never had time at the end of the semester, and so when I got to grad school, I took a class entirely dedicated to the genetics of mitochondria and chloroplasts. It sounded like a good idea at the time, and actually there were some things that are interesting, but I already worked a lot with bacterial genetics, and what you learn is there's a lot of similarity between bacterial genetics and the genetics of organelles and chloroplasts. And we'll talk about why that is and how that plays out. Just a reminder, I think most of you guys had 197 here. I assume Paul Garris, being a very dedicated guy, went over this. But the structures of mitochondria and chloroplasts, there are some similarities to them. They are double membrane organelles. They're located within the cytoplasm of their cells. The one mistake not to make is plant cells have both. Don't think in terms of animal cells have mitochondria, plant cells have chloroplasts. Plant cells have both chloroplasts and mitochondria. Both have evolved from bacteria, and they both have highly convoluted intermembrane structures. The whole purpose of all of those folds and the intermembrane of these organelles is because their energetic reactions, some of their energetic reactions, take place via electron transport chains, and the components of the electron transport chains are floating in the membrane. So the more intermembrane you have as a mitochondria or a chloroplast, the more of those, larger number of those proteins that you can have, the more efficient you could be at your energetic reactions. But they also have their own chromosome. And so in the case of mitochondria, it's located in the matrix, which is a very dense fluid within the inner membrane. And in the chloroplast, the DNA is located out in the stroma, which again is a thick fluid between the two sets of membranes. Okay, but the chromosomes are circular, like bacterial chromosomes are. Okay. So I've mentioned this before, but the idea about you get half of your DNA from your father, half of your DNA from your mother is not technically correct for a couple of reasons. If you are male in particular, if you're male, you got a Y chromosome from dad. Mom provided an X. There's a lot more information on the X chromosome than the Y. But even if you're female and you got an X from both parents, you inherit all of your mitochondria from mom. So all of that DNA that's contained in the mitochondria in the egg came from mom. So she gets a slightly greater contribution in terms of genetics than does dad. And so in animals, this is the case that it's referred to as uniparental inheritance, and it's maternally inherited. You get it from mom because the egg is this relatively large cell that is ready to act as a receptor for the sperm. The sperm wants to be streamlined, so all the mitochondria in a sperm are located in a collar to power the tail to move them. But you also get, you can have distinctive DNA within the cytoplasm of a single cell. So what happens is the mitochondrion is a really harsh environment. You can think about the inside of a mitochondrion being, you know, like a planet surface on a science fiction movie when they land, and it's really harsh, and, you know, the environment's really nasty, and, you know, like one of the Aliens movies when they pop out there. it's not fun being on the inside of a mitochondrion. Those reactions that are taking place, the electron transport reactions, the energetic reactions, produce reactive molecules. So you get reactive oxygen radicals, reactive hydrogen molecules, and it's really tough to be a polymer inside of a mitochondrion because those reactive molecules will interact with proteins, they'll interact with nucleic acids, and they'll cause damage. And so the mutation rate in DNA within a mitochondrion is higher than it is in genomic DNA in a eukaryotic organism. So what happens is over time you can get mutation in the DNA. Both mitochondria and chloroplast basically divide like bacteria, that they divide by binary fission, that a mitochondrion will split in half and then you'll have two daughter mitochondria. A chloroplast will split in half, you'll get two daughter chloroplasts. And so all of the offspring that result from that division will have that mutation in there. But within the cell, so here's, we'll say that the red is the original sequence and blue carry the mutation. There's no organized division of mitochondria during cell division like there is chromosomes. Okay, it's just kind of random where a mitochondria is during cytokinesis, cell division, part of the cell replication. And so as a result, when you get more than one lineage, so in this case we've got some of each of them, but after this division we see now we've got three with the original, one with the mutant, three with the mutant, one with the original. So there will be differences in the way that those mitochondria function. Each cell has four mitochondria, but depending on the severity of that mutation, whether it's neutral or beneficial or detrimental, that this one with three of the mutants will probably behave differently than this one with three of the originals. And then you get replication of those mitochondria. Again, they just divide by binary fission. Then the cells get ready to divide. And that separation of the mitochondria, again, isn't orchestrated. And so here we get one that's got four with the mutant in it. So there are no wild-type mitochondria in this cell. And we've got wild-type in all the others, this one 3-in-1, 3-in-1, 2-in-2. So as a result of that random nature of how mitochondria and chloroplasts are divided up between a cell, you get this diversity in the sequences of mitochondria across a multicellular organism. And that coupled with the relatively high mutation rate inside of a mitochondrion means that you're essentially a mosaic for mitochondrial sequences. And some of the diseases in humans associated with mitochondrial genes, they typically develop later in life because of this phenomenon, and they typically are mosaic diseases, that you'll see a problem in certain parts of the body but not others just as a result of this lineage and at what point it happened in the person's life. Greg LeMond, who is once again the best American rider ever to win the Tour de France. He took a break behind that other guy for a decade and a half, but Greg LeMond was an American cyclist, won the Tour de France a couple times, two or three times. And he developed a mitochondrial disease that involved his mitochondria didn't produce that much energy. And it was a mutation that happened, and it happened to be in like one of his leg muscles was one of the areas that the mosaicism took place. So he went from being arguably the best bike rider in the world to he couldn't ride his bike around the block. And then they diagnosed it. It's a disease that can be treated with medicine, so now he's back out there doing rides for charity and stuff. But it was a mitochondrial mutation, and it just happened to affect the cells involved in large muscles in his legs. So just a reminder as to why mitochondria and chloroplasts behave like bacteria. It's because in essence they still are bacteria that are tucked inside of your cells. There's an author, Lynn Margolis, and she makes the argument that there are no eukaryotes. It's just a collection of bacteria. You're just a very well-organized collection of bacteria with a purpose in life. But so here's the theory as to how mitochondria and chloroplast came to be, that there was an early anaerobic eukaryotic cell. This part of it's up in the air now because there have been some extremophilic bacteria that have been identified that have what are referred to as protonuclear membranes. So they have membrane-like structures surrounding their chromosome. So now the model's been modified so that one of those bacteria could serve instead of this early eukaryotic cell. But you've got the DNA sort of sequestered away behind some membrane or proto-membrane. And this organism was fairly durable, had a membrane that allowed it to survive in harsh environments. Then there's a eubacterium, that means true bacteria, not an archaea. And this guy was really good at breaking down carbohydrates, but it's not very durable in the environment. And they even tell you which type of bacterium it is. It's alpha proteobacterium. You don't need to know that. But this thing's not durable, really good at breaking down carbohydrates, and it invades this other cell. Holy buckets. One time I taught the last half of this class with Dr. Katz, and the day that they were taking final exams, we were, Williams is over by the arena, or no, Turner. And the day of final exam, we were just separated by the other classroom by one of those accordion partitions. And their last day of class, they were watching a movie all about breastfeeding. And I had a room of 20-year-old guys trying to concentrate on a final when they're talking about, you know, tugging on certain anatomical features to start things happening. It was a nightmare. So, okay. So, this bacterium that's good at breaking down macromolecules gets inside of this durable one, and it persists. That it was a mutualistic symbiotic relationship. Both parties benefited. And actually, there's a bacterium that's in the world right now that very closely resembles this one. It's a member of the genus Rickettsia. It causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever is one of the diseases that Rickettsia will cause. And Rickettsia have to get inside of host cells. They're just so fragile out on their own that they go from being inside of an insect vector to when they bite you that they invade your cells. So this idea of an invasive Rickettsial-like cell that's pretty good at breaking down macromolecules but isn't so durable in the environment is supported by closely related bacteria that we see in the world today. So that worked out well. The little red guy got protection from the environment by the membrane of the ancient eukaryotic cell. And now the eukaryotic cell benefited because it could only break down carbohydrates to a certain extent. But this now the intracellular bacterium could break those down further. It got more ATP, so the combination both benefited, so they decided to hang out for a while. But that's why mitochondria divide on their own. It's essentially a parasitic bacterium living inside of your cells. So when it gets big enough and wobbly enough, it replicates its chromosome and it divides into two. You'll never see a mitochondria, you know, break into, you know, four smaller parts. It's always binary fission. They get big and they split into two, just like a bacterium. But over time, what happened is evolution leading to a specialized structure. Right? That red bacterium didn't have to survive out in the environment anymore. Its main job was energy extraction. And so genes in its chromosome that were required for living outside were lost over time. They weren't needed anymore. It was greater effort to replicate them. So when they were lost, that organism was at an advantage over ones that still retained those unneeded genes. It's a phenomenon called genome reduction, that tendency of prokaryotic genomes not to have any unneeded DNA in them. Okay. So the genome got smaller and smaller and smaller so that only genes that were involved in energetics were retained at some point in time. And then also the structure of the bacterium changed, where you get that increase of intermembrane structures. And we see that with bacteria, where they can have overproduction of either inner or outer membranes. If they're gram-negative, they have two membranes. And you can get overproduction of either inner or outer. If it's overproduction of inner membranes, they'll form folds on the inside of the cell. So I've actually seen mutants in the bacteria that I work on that overproduce their inner membrane, and they produce finger-like, cristae-like projections, like you see in a mitochondrion. And then the next idea is photosynthesis evolved originally in bacteria. And Joe Armstrong, one of my colleagues in the department, has written a book on the evolution of photosynthesis. And photosystems 1 and 2 evolved independently and eventually came together. But in this case, we just have a cyanobacterium. They used to be called blue-green algae. We now know that they're bacteria. And that gets internalized into this cell with a mitochondrion and a nuclear membrane. And over time, similar thing happens. It undergoes genome reduction and evolution for specialized features, particularly expansion of the inner membrane. And then you get a present-day plant cell here with a nuclear membrane, mitochondria, and chloroplast. And over here, a present-day animal cell with a nuclear membrane and mitochondria. So a lot of the rules that we've talked about for prokaryotic genetics are true for these organelles. They'll have a circular chromosome. There's not much space between the genes. But one of the things that's happened in evolution over time is, while there was that genome reduction originally, over time there's been some transfer of genes from the organelle, either the mitochondria or the chloroplast, from their genome to the nuclear chromosomes, and vice versa. And so different organisms will see genes that look distinctively eukaryotic and chromosomal present on the mitochondria or the chloroplast genome. And that varies from organism to organism. Okay, so as a result of this variable sort of movement of genes, we classify the mitochondrial genomes. Since all eukaryotes have mitochondria, mitochondria are the ones that we use for classification. And so we have a couple of terms. Ancestral, these are probably worthwhile knowing. Okay. And derived. Ancestral just means that their mitochondrial genome retains many of the characteristics of the common ancestor. Derived means that there's been more transfer of DNA between the organism's chromosome and the organelles. Okay, so it's less similar to the common ancestor. And that's due to DNA transfer from chromosome to the organelle. Okay. And so one of the traits that we look at when we do a genome on a eukaryotic organism is, what does its mitochondrial genome look like? Is it an ancestral genome? Is it a derived genome? So humans, mitochondrial DNA, if you've had an anthropology class, mitochondrial DNA is how they figure out lineages of humans and ancient humans. And again, since you get your mitochondrial DNA from mom, that essentially we're looking at female lineages in humans. When we look at mitochondrial DNA, even if you're a guy, your mitochondria is from your mom, so we think in terms of maternal DNA. And in humans, you've got, it's a double-stranded, okay, so one of the things that was kind of tough to read on one of the earlier exams is the structure between prokaryotes and eukaryotes of their chromosomes. Even though prokaryotes have a circular chromosome, they're still double-stranded DNA molecules with double helix within the circles. It's just that eukaryotic chromosomes tend to be a linear molecule, but they've got the double helix as well. So these circular chromosomes have two strands of DNA that are held together by base pairs, just like every other piece of DNA that we've talked about, or almost every other piece of DNA that we've talked about. Except in humans, the genes aren't spread out evenly. We talked about there will be a template and a non-template strand in transcription, and you can have genes transcribed in different directions depending on which strand is the template. In human mitochondrial DNA, one strand serves as the template strand for the vast majority of genes. The other strand is just a template for a small number of genes, and they're called H and L for heavy and light. And H serves as a template for the vast majority of genes that are present in your mitochondrial genome, and L is the template for only a small number of genes. So here's a map of the human mitochondrial chromosome. And so the inner one, as depicted here, is the L strand. The outer one is the H strand. And the key here, purple, are showing genes that are expressed as a protein. The green colors express a tRNA. And the kind of teal colors express ribosomal RNA genes. So you've got a 12S and a 16S in the mitochondria, similar to what you have in bacteria for the ribosomals. But you need to produce all the tRNAs that you need because translation of these proteins takes place within the mitochondria. Okay? So the vast majority of these you can see are on the H strand or the heavy strand, and then just a few of them are on the L. There's really only one protein that's encoded on the L strand. The rest are tRNAs. Okay, so that's really unusual. Most other organisms, there's much better balance between the two strands of which one serves as a template for any particular gene. So humans have a very asymmetric mitochondrial genome. The other thing that I've mentioned it a few times when we talked about translation, that not all translation goes off of that same table. It's referred to as non-universal codons, and mitochondria are the most common place where you'll see variation from that table that I gave you to do those translation problems, that there are some changes. So here we've got UGA going from a stop to a tryptophan, and mitochondria and AUA goes from isoleucine to methionine, and AGA goes from an arginine to, in your case, it's a stop. In fruit flies, it's a serine, and in yeast, it's an arginine. So there are multiple labs around the world that are looking at this evolution of the AGA codon and how that plays out in evolution when you're going from, you know, one out of 64 codons has a dramatically different outcome in organisms. And actually, humans and fruit flies are considered fairly closely related in terms of genetics. So that's a big variation to have in the mitochondria of your cells. Okay, so some of the other things with the genetics. I want to see if we got the story about the volcano here. Oh, So it's coming up in a bit. All right. So some of the other properties of the organelles and their genetics. Remember, they're randomly replicating, so their replication is not linked to the replication timetable of the cell in which they reside. When they get big enough, they replicate on their own. So they replicate their chromosome. They undergo organelle division. And again, there's from organism to organism, the regulation of transcription and translation varies quite a bit. So much more so within the organelles than we see within the chromosome or the nuclear genes. Okay. So evolution of mitochondrial DNA. They've been able to develop this phylogenetic map. That's just sort of a family tree of all living things based on mitochondrial DNA, and they look at the changes over time. The more distantly related things are, the more changes that there will be within the ancestral part of their genomes. Okay, you have to kind of ignore that whole transfer from the nucleus. You look at the parts that are still retained, and you look at the number of base changes to determine how distantly related things are. And even within humans, that they can do that, and they can take a look at how much variation there is in human DNA, and there's a certain mutation rate that we would expect in mitochondria. And then there was this big dilemma that happened in humans, and it was there seemed to be much less mitochondrial variation in humans than was expected. And so they went back and they were doing the genetics, and then an explanation was that there was a bottleneck. There had originally been a larger human population. There was a bottleneck, a fairly dramatic bottleneck, in which the number of humans on the planet was dropped to a very small number. And then as a result, all of us around now are a descendant of one of that relatively small number of humans. So there's less variation now than when they go back and they look at samples previous. And so you can imagine people were coming up with a bunch of theories that the first one, well, that would just be Noah's family then would explain that, and sorry that it's a larger number than six or eight or whatever it was. But then at about the same time that geologists were looking into things, and the human bottleneck ties in most closely with a really traumatic event. There was the last super volcanic eruption that's understood was on Toba, and it basically spewed forth huge amounts of ash and cooled things off, and the human population dropped down to probably somewhere around 10,000 humans across the planet. And then as a result, that was the big bottleneck event. We've seen bottleneck events in other organisms, and we see very similar traits, that there's very little variation in the mitochondrial DNA through a bottleneck event. Cheetahs almost died off in the last few thousand years, and then their population is recovering now. So cheetahs are very closely related, almost identical at the mitochondrial level, and also they're all very closely related. It's oftentimes tough to get cheetahs to breed successfully in captivity because they're like all eighth cousins or closer at this point. So, but that's a way that human history is being mapped out biologically, is through mitochondrial DNA. And then we get one of our baseball cards for a model organism, and this one is for yeast. Brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It's a eukaryote. Yeast are eukaryotes, but they are single-celled organisms that float around. You can grow them in liquid broth. You could grow them on agar plates. But the way that their chromosomes divide, very similar to the way that humans do. So yeast are, in fact, a model organism for humans. But much of the work in eukaryotic transcription factors and termination was done in yeast. Takes about twice as long to grow up yeast as it does E. coli. So you'd have to let your plates go for two nights. Yeast don't like 37 degrees. They like 30 degrees centigrade. But the best part about working with yeast is when you walk into the lab, it smells like a bakery. You get that nice yeasty bread smell when you work in a yeast lab, so that's better than working with E. coli. But you're working with a eukaryotic system, and especially better than working with Klebsiella, which smells like a latrine. So if you're going to go into molecular genetics and you want to pick your organisms, yeast is a nice one to work with. And then chloroplasts are kind of the me too organelle that much of the work's been done in mitochondria. With chloroplasts, transcription and translation are very similar to bacterial. In mitochondria, there's more variation from organism to organism, how their transcription translation is regulated. Within chloroplasts, they follow the rules of, you know, minus 10, minus 35 promoters, Shine-Delgarno sequences for translation pretty closely. So there's less variation in chloroplasts than there is mitochondria. And then this is just restating that idea that there's this transfer of genes between the nuclear chromosomes and the organelle chromosomes. All right. So aging, we've already talked about telomeres, right? And how telomeres shorten, and that tends to affect your connective tissue, so your ability to express collagen is affected as you get older. That's what causes wrinkles. You're not producing enough connective tissue underneath to fill in the gaps anymore, so you start getting wrinkles. Your skin's not as flexible as it once was for the same reason. Your joints get kind of achy because your chondrocytes aren't padding the joints quite as well. And so what results in is you get rubbing, and so you produce more fluid, and so your joints get kind of puffy and achy. That's telomere shortening. We also talked about just the accumulation of mutation over time when we talked about that story with Dolly having, you know, old chromosomes. Even if they would have treated Dolly's chromosomes with a telomerase and extended the telomeres, there was still an accumulation of mutation just associated with being alive. And so that accumulation of mutations in the chromosomal DNA is nothing compared to what it's like inside of your mitochondria. Again, the really harsh conditions are tough on the DNA. So you accumulate mutations at a much higher rate, and that accumulation of mutation is associated with aging. There seems to be a threshold that you hit. In humans, the age tends to be about 60, where your mitochondria just don't function as efficiently anymore. You can still undergo cell renewal. You can, you know, produce new mitochondria, break down the old ones, have new ones that are produced by binary fission, but they just don't function quite as well. So that's when you start, you know, having dinner at Denny's at 4:45 and you're asleep watching a rerun of Matlock by 8 o'clock. It's because you're just not producing as much energy as you used to. And again, the best way to prevent this, you know, diet's a lot of it, antioxidants. But the best indication now is maintaining activity as long as you can. That the more active you are, that pushes mitochondrial division at a faster rate, and then you can hope that some of that asymmetric cell division takes place and you get more cells that have more of the good mitochondria and they'll function better. But it blows getting old right now. So you guys will have all this stuff figured out there. They already figured out what causes baldness now. It's prostaglandin 2, so within 48 months, there'll be a new drug out for male pattern baldness, because currently the two drugs that have made it through the FDA the fastest are minoxidil and Viagra, are the two drugs that have been approved the fastest by FDA. So if you ever see the panel that approves drugs, you'll understand why. It's a bunch of middle-aged, pudgy guys with bad hairlines. So coming soon, you guys will have great heads of hair until you're 100, and then they'll figure out telomerase, and then they'll figure out the mitochondria, and then there will be 15 billion of you good-looking 90-year-olds on the planet fighting for food and water. So enjoy that. You'll never be able to watch Logan's Run the same way again. So, okay. So development. And development, again, is a huge field of biology, and it's one of them that's kind of late coming to the table because we just didn't have the tools to study it very well. There are three of my colleagues in the school that probably consider themselves developmental biologists, or at least they are cell biologists that work on a developmental process. But developmental biology is basically how you go from being a fertilized egg to looking like the fully formed organism that you are at birth, or in some cases, there's still some developmental biology that takes place during maturation and adolescence. So cells need to move. Cells need to expand. Right? If all the cells stayed where they were and all the cells in a fertilized egg underwent cell division at exactly the same rate, you would be a huge sphere when you're born. So cells have to divide at different rates. Cells have to move. In some cases, some cells have to die. If you had me in 197, you got this example that when your hand is developing, your hand doesn't start out as a little, you know, fist, and then you get little nubbins of fingers that expand and expand and expand. That's not the way your hand develops. Your hand develops something that looks like a canoe paddle, where it's sort of flat and broad and filled in. And so this is where your hand wants to be with the fingers, and it's shaped like a paddle. And what happens? All of these cells in these areas get a signal to die. And what you're left then are separate fingers, unless you're the man from Atlantis or Aquaman, and then these bits stay intact too. Okay. But so cells are moving, cells are expanding at different rates, or in some cases cells are dying. And those are the three main things that you look at in developmental biology. But how do the right cells know what they're supposed to do? That there have to be these signals where, okay, I'm at a certain location, I'm going to be a hand. So first thing is I have to expand and move to make this kayak-like or this paddle-like structure. And then at a certain point in time, I could be sitting right here. I could be the lucky one. I'm the last one on the ring finger. And the one right beside me gets the signal to die. He's not needed inner finger tissue cell number 3052. Right? That two cells side by side, one of them gets the signal to die, one of them gets to be a ring finger. How are those signals sent? How are they regulated? We're pretty clueless in developmental biology right now. Like I said, it's a fairly new area. There's a lot of unknown stuff. If you want a really nice career as a biologist, look into developmental biology because it's very important. You know, that understanding how things develop is a huge part of understanding their biology just on a fundamental level. A lot of biomedical questions in humans occur during developmental stages. So one of the model organisms for development is the fruit fly, okay, Drosophila melanogaster. And here's just a little bit of a life cycle so that you kind of understand what we'll be looking at. But you get an egg that's laid, and it only takes about a week to 9 days from an egg to a mature fruit fly. Fruit flies don't live very long, so they basically eat and try to reproduce. That's the wonderful, enjoyable life of a fruit fly. But they start out as an egg. A few hours later, you actually start seeing some cell division in there. 5 to 8 hours, there have already been enough cell divisions that we can start to see major rearrangements and some of the body segments taking place. After 10 hours, we can start to see segments that we can identify what they will be later. After a day, then it becomes a small larvae. 2 days, so when it's a small larvae, it just eats. In the larval stage, these things just eat and expand. And there's very little change in shape as a larvae. They're just expansion at this point. third day, then they're really good size. In case you haven't done the translation, if you've never worked with a Drosophila lab, Drosophila larvae or fly larvae in general, if you just see them at home, you would call them a maggot. Okay, but that's so when you see maggots on spoiled food, you're really seeing insect larvae, so typically fly larvae. And so when you notice them and they're big and fat and happy and like sitting up and kind of looking at you when you open up the fruit crisper, they're typically like day two or three. They're pretty good size at that point. And then they pupate, and when they pupate, they've done the expansion. At that point, they don't eat anymore, but between the third day of larvae and pupation, there's huge amounts of cell movements that take place. You go in, you know, looking like this, and you come out looking like that. There's huge amounts of cell movements that are taking place to take all of these cells that are here and move them into the fact that you've got wings and you've got these big red eyes, and so they're not eating anymore. They're not bringing in any new raw material. So it's divided. When you're a fruit fly, those two things are divided. When you're a larvae, you're expanding. When you're pupated, stuff's moving all over the place. Okay, and aside from developmental disease, scientists that study developmental processes oftentimes are cancer researchers. When we talk about cancers, you can either have a benign tumor or a malignant tumor. Benign tumors are in place. They're still connected to their cells. They're just replicating quickly. With malignant tumors, they let go. And in some cases, they specifically migrate to other parts of the body. They're receiving signals that are developmental in nature. It's like, oh, okay, you started out in the liver. You know what? Let's form a brain now. Let's try to get up to the brain. And so some of these malignant tumors, the way that they move is called metastasis. It resembles developmental processes. So understanding these is one of the ways that cancer researchers are looking at it. Okay, so what we're really going to look at here is this early egg stage and how that plays out in figuring out what's a head, what's a tail, what's a back, what's a belly. Okay, and that's referred to as polarity. When we're trying to determine one side from the other. So on a fly, when we look at the adult fly, we've got anterior means towards the head, posterior means towards the backside or the bottom. Okay, then we've got ventral means the belly, and dorsal means the back. So when we talk in terms of polarity of the egg, what needs to happen is early on that polarity needs to be established. Cells need to have a sense which direction they're supposed to move, so you need the biological equivalent of north, south, east, and west. You need dorsal, ventral, anterior, posterior, so the cells have a biological compass to use. So this is going to be based off of proteins that we'll talk about, but what sort of slowed scientists down for a while is they would detect these proteins that were present in greater concentrations, but in the egg itself, they couldn't pick up the expression of these genes. And so they thought, okay, that's weird. We got all this protein. It's got to be coming from someplace. Then somebody went back and they looked, and what happens is, as mom is laying the eggs, she deposits mRNA for these proteins in the egg. And so it's actually messenger RNA that was produced in mom's cell, so it's referred to as a maternal origin. Mom made the RNA, but the proteins will be produced and the proteins will migrate to determine these poles. Let's see. So what's happening inside of an egg? Here's the fertilized egg. Then you start getting cell division on the inside. And then what happens, those cells start to move to the perimeter. And so you get this lining of cells and some cell expansion at one end. And then over time you get this set of columnar cells that line the inside of the egg. Okay, so don't think about it being filled with a bunch of expanding cells. What happens is first they make a lining of the inside of the egg. And so there's already a lot of movement and variable expansion. And at some points, relatively early, so 10 hours in, so at 2 hours, the egg already has dorsal, ventral, posterior, anterior poles. Okay, so 2 hours within being fertilized, there are already poles to this egg, and the cells now have the ability to determine which direction to move. 10 hours in, you can start to see cell expansion and movement that mimics the different parts of the body. So this blue shaded area will be correspond to the cells that will eventually be in the abdomen. These yellow shaded are the thorax, and these red shaded ones are in the head. So 10 hours in, a fly developing embryo already has moved and organized enough that we know that this is going to be the head, this is going to be the thorax, and this will be the abdomen. So it's very rapid, and that's facilitated by the fact that mom deposits those mRNA molecules that can produce proteins very rapidly. Okay. So the first one that we'll talk about is dorsal ventral. How do you develop the pole between dorsal and ventral, the back and the belly of the developing organism? All right. I've warned you in the past about Drosophila geneticists tend to name things based on what the mutant looks like. Okay. So if you find a mutant that can't do something, you name it for that, the mutation. So the normal gene would actually do the opposite. The normal gene would give you a normal function. So if you've got a wobbly fly, a fly that's really uncoordinated, you've got a gene called uncoordinated. That gene actually is involved in the development of coordination of a fly, is what you get. So we're going to talk about a protein that's called dorsal, and it actually does more to develop the ventral surface. Okay. But with dorsal, the main thing is, where is the protein located? The protein will be located in all the cells, but it's a matter of whether it's nuclear or whether it's cytoplasmic. Okay. So if dorsal is in the nucleus, okay, if the protein gets inside of the nucleus, then that starts promoting the development of ventral features. If the dorsal, the dorsal protein in the cytoplasm should promote dorsal features. Okay, so here's a way to look at it. We've just taken a developing embryo and we cut a section of it off and we take a look, and the purple color corresponds with the dorsal protein. Okay? If you've got the dorsal protein that's localizing within the nuclear membrane, inside the nucleus, that will produce ventral features. If the dorsal protein is staying out of the nucleus and is staying in the cytoplasm, that will cause the production of dorsal or back features. All the cells have dorsal. The ones on the side have it a little bit in the nucleus, a little bit in the cytoplasm. And so you need to think about these proteins when we talk in terms of developmental biology as a gradient. Okay, it's not always going to be a case of does it have it or does it not have it. It's a matter of to what extent it has it compared to nearby cells. And so we'll tend to taper off or see gradients. Here we see very strong cytoplasmic. Here we see very strong nuclear. And in between, we see intermediate levels of both. Okay? And that's how you get the development of back, belly, and sides, is through this relative differential of where the dorsal protein is located within these cells. Okay? And then here's a stain for that, showing you this is what it would look like in a real research setting. Okay. All right, so for anterior, posterior, we're going to ignore hunchback. We're going to keep things a little bit more basic here. I want you to know bicoid and nanos. And bicoid is responsible for the production of anterior structures, so the head. We'll see more bicoid at the anterior part of the developing embryo. Nanos is responsible for posterior structures, so tail and abdomen structures for nanos. Okay. And these, again, are maternal mRNAs that are present. And what happens is the mRNA is present at different ends at different concentrations. So this is with bicoid. So bicoid promotes anterior structure. So at the anterior end, we've got more mRNA. That mRNA is going to be translated, which means we're going to produce bicoid protein near the anterior end of the embryo in the first few hours. Remember, mRNA is not a really stable molecule, so it tends to break down, but mom gave us a head start. We've got an mRNA molecule that will persist for a few hours. So this is a diagram. This is an actual photograph from a lab where they've hybridized. They use a probe to identify the bicoid-specific mRNA, and you see it's located at the anterior end. And then here's a one where they look at the protein. And you can see the bicoid protein localizes along the outer edge, but it's more concentrated in the anterior end. You don't see anything going on the posterior end with bicoid. So we've got this gradient. Just don't think about it. These cells have bicoid, these cells don't. We've got this gradient. We've got one end where there's really high bicoid concentration, and then that concentration drops the further away you get from it. You get to the point where there's essentially nothing until you get all the way to this end, okay, to the posterior end. Opposite story with nanos, but again, it's maternal mRNA is deposited at the posterior end. Here's the stain for the mRNA, and here's the stain for the nanos protein. And so very high concentration here, and then it's kind of tough to see on this slide, but you can see it. There's light brown, so we still have nanos protein out to here, and then you get to the point that it's really tough to detect. Okay, but I want you to keep in mind that you've got this combination now, where if you start at the anterior end, you now have two molecules that you can sense and start to develop a pretty good sense for how close from one end you are or how close to the other end you are. So if you start at the anterior end, it's all bicoid, no nanos. And you start walking away, and the bicoid concentration drops. We're walking towards the posterior end. We're starting at the head, going towards the butt. Bicoid is dropping. We get to an area where there's very little bicoid, very little nanos. And then we start walking, and now nanos is picking up. We're getting less and less bicoid, but now we're starting to sense that there's more bicoid present. More and more and more, and then we get to here, and it's all bicoid, no nanos. So those two molecules at opposite ends basically makes a twofold gradient across the entire length. And so depending on the relative concentrations of those two molecules, it's pretty easy for cells to determine where they are. And cells will expand or move based on the relative abundance of bicoid and nanos. And so it's positioning based on the concentrations of those molecules as opposed to, oh, I know I'm half a centimeter from the end. It's molecular concentrations that matter. Okay. Then on top of fruit flies, just real quickly, I don't expect you to know this in great detail. I included a few extra slides, but we'll skip over that. But there are other classes of genes in addition to the polarity genes, all those body segments, that there are specific genes just involved in controlling the segments, controlling the gaps in between the segments where they kind of bunch up. There are some genes that affect every other segment And so there has to be this sense of which segment you're in as to whether you're expressed or not expressed. There are some that are involved in expression in adjacent segments, but not, you know, ones outside of that. So it's really complicated. We just talked about the first step of developing that polarity in the egg, but there are quite a few classes of gene regulations and movements. All right, And then this is just that programmed cell death is referred to as apoptosis. It's a good term to know. And because it's different than just when your cells die because of either injury or infection, that's referred to as necrosis. And necrosis, when your cells die, your cells, it's this really ugly thing, and they sort of pop and they spew out their cellular goodness into the surrounding areas. With apoptosis, it's programmed. The cells basically are told to suck it up and take it like a man and just die silently and not spill out a bunch of stuff. So they don't leak out, that they just basically degrade themselves from the inside out. And so it's a signal that's sent during development. So the same thing happens during during infections. If you get infected with a virus, your immune system comes up. Your immune system can't fight a virus outside of cells inside of cells very well. If a virus is outside of cells, then antibodies work. Macrophages can do their job. But if you've got a virus inside of your respiratory tract during cold and flu season, what your immune system does is T cells will walk up. They'll notice that a cell is infected with the virus, and it basically gives them a Clint Eastwood moment where it says, okay, either you can pull the trigger or I can pull the trigger. And so either T cells can kill the cell directly, or they could send a signal to carry out apoptosis where the infected cell kills itself, and then the viruses are exposed to antibodies and phagocytic cells. So you carry out apoptosis every time that you have a viral infection. Most of the symptoms associated with a viral infection are actually your immune system killing off cells. Your nose is irritated when you have a cold because you're killing off cells in the lining of your respiratory tract in your nose to get rid of the virus. So apoptosis happens on a regular basis. It's controlled cell death or directed cell death. Evo-devo is a term that we use to understand evolution through development. How humans develop and how fish develop and how reptiles develop, they sort of parallel to a point and then they branch off. So comparative developmental biology has an evolutionary component to it. There used to be a phrase about ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's not true if somebody says that to you at a cocktail party, because I know people say to me all the time, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Slap them. Slap them hard and keep slapping them until they agree not to say that again. All right. Okay, so immune genetics, we'll get this started. We may have to carry this over a bit. We'll at least talk about some terminology today. And immunology is one of the fields of biology that's really late to the table. Immunology used to be the astrology of the life sciences, that immunologists could identify cells and there would be certain proteins expressed on the cells, but they had no idea what they did. And so it's like, oh, if there's an intracellular infection, then this marker is present. They just gave them numbers. So if you study immunology, it's like CD1 through 140 are outer membrane proteins that are expressed. But they would figure out the configuration. Oh, we've got CD4 positive, CD8 negative. So they could tell the alignment of the stars, but they didn't know mechanisms. And it's really been the last 20 years that immunologists have been able to step up and describe mechanisms to explain all those configurations of cell markers. So some of the terminology that you need to know, antigen. An antigen is a molecule that elicits an immune response or can be recognized by your immune system. Okay. Some molecules are great antigens. Other molecules are terrible antigens. At different times in your life, that may change. So, for example, until you're about the age of 6, carbohydrates are terrible antigens for kids, that their immune system just doesn't see carbohydrates very well. So one of the problems that kids used to have, a really serious disease, is bacterial meningitis. And the bacteria that caused most of that, there were two bacteria that did it, they had carbohydrate-based capsules. And so they could just float through the bloodstream or through the central nervous system of these kids, and their immune system could not pick up on those capsules as being antigenic. After you start to age, your body sees antigens or sees carbohydrates as antigenic. Proteins tend to make the best antigens. Okay. And really, when we're talking about proteins making antigens, we're really talking about small segments of protein. So somewhere between like 6 to 14 amino acids would be the size of a protein that the immune system would be able to recognize. And this is determined by the three-dimensional shape. Okay. So if you can mimic a three-dimensional shape, the immune system will respond to that molecule the same as the original antigen. Okay. An antibody. Okay. Please do not confuse antibiotic with antibody. Antibodies are classes of proteins that are produced by the host that bind to antigen. Okay. An antibiotic is a foreign molecule that is introduced as a drug to kill off infectious agents. Antibodies are part of your normal immune system that you produce. The only thing that I want you to know here is MHC, Major Histocompatibility Complex. I'll just call it MHC. If you see it on the test, it will be MHC. You will not have to write out the full term. Okay? But what MHC is, it's an important part of the ability to tell self from not self. If I have to give you the definition of an immune system as succinctly as I can, an immune system of any organism, its role is identify self from not self, destroy not self. Okay? So it's essentially a really bad Star Trek episode where they give a robot this, you know, I probe this instruction and send it out into the universe. Tell self from not self, kill not self. That's what your immune system does. MHC does a big part in that identification of self from not self. So what happens is you have molecules that are present on your cell surface, and they reach inside and they grab proteins and they stick it to the, out on the outside. And then other components of your immune system, other cells come up, and they look at that, and they go, nope, that's just us, yourself. And then the cells do it. And so this scaffold on which they present these internal proteins are MHC. Now, if you've got a viral infection, viruses are really messy house guests, that they produce a lot of proteins that are floating around. MHC reaches in there, it grabs a viral protein, it holds it up. And now the cells in the immune response, they come up, they look at that, and they go, wow, that's not us. That's not self. And that's when they have that conversation about, all right, you need to take one for the team now, guy. But MHC is also the component that's involved in organ rejection during transplants, that they try to match your MHC as close as they can, because that arm that I'm holding up that's holding the protein is part of the recognition process too. So all of a sudden, if you've got a kidney with somebody else's MHC and it's in there grabbing normal human proteins, the immune response is going to go, well, this bit out here looks fine, but I'm not quite so sure about the scaffold that it's on. And your immune system starts to fight against the transplanted organ. So MHC, it presents antigens, but it's also a part of the self versus not self. Okay, we'll stop there and we'll finish up with immunogenetics then on Thursday. And remember, there will be a quick homework assignment online. It'll be about the Drosophila polarity and the mitochondrial genome.